Okay, good evening everyone. Again, my apologies for being late. While this was not intentional, I think this scenario illustrates what I want to talk about this evening. So even though privacy is something that we'll be spending a lot of time talking about, including in the context of location, there are clearly lots of scenarios where it would be good to actually make that location visible to others so they can come and grab you and get you to the right room. And we'll be talking about that in more detail again this evening. Essentially, what I'd like to do is I'd like to provide you with a little bit of context for what is happening in this space when it comes to location and the privacy issues that many of these scenarios give rise to. What's important to understand is that privacy is a concept that's not necessarily very easy to define when it comes to the nitty-gritty. It's a fundamental concept, it's a fundamental right that's actually that has its roots in a number of fundamental texts. It's considered to be a fundamental human right, and it's also present in various constitutional documents. But at the same time, when you try to articulate that concept in different contexts, such as information privacy, which is obviously a very broad space by itself, and more specifically in the context of location, you find that as a society, we're confronted very often to new kinds of usage scenarios that perhaps were not necessarily foreseen by people who initially developed or refined some of these concepts in the context of different contexts such as information or such as location. And therefore, as a society, we are basically confronted with a situation where we need to collectively ask ourselves, what does this really mean for us? And obviously, as it is the case in many situations, you find that there are different forces that are pulling you in different directions. On the one hand, some of you in this room might very well be involved in the telecom industry and have jobs that are related to web commerce and potentially even mobile commerce, and might very well benefit from applications that leverage someone's location. At the same time, perhaps as consumers, you don't necessarily feel completely comfortable with some of the things that you hear about or that you might actually be experiencing firsthand. And so these are the kinds of things that I'd like to talk about. This is an area that I've been researching for the past 10 years, and one where I'd like to also this evening share some light on when it comes to perhaps understanding, at least at a very initial stage, what are potentially some of the cultural differences within this space. What you find is that very often people who are doing research in this area tend to focus on perhaps how people in the United States feel about these issues, but what does that mean about people in Hong Kong or on the mainland? And while I definitely don't claim to have the final answer to these questions, I would like at least to share with you some preliminary results in this area that I think are interesting. Having done that, and I'll try to illustrate why, based on this data that I'll be sharing with you, this area is so challenging, and why people keep on embarrassing themselves, and why people also keep on scratching their head in terms of what it's going to take for us to perhaps strike a good balance between these different forces that I'm going to be discussing this evening. I'll then try to conclude by outlining what I believe are some promising paths in this area in terms of reconciling these different forces, and I'll conclude by also talking about how location privacy in many ways is just a harbinger of future privacy debates, taking into account the fact that location is just one contextual attribute in a very broad space of attributes that you might want to leverage in the context of mobile applications or more broadly pervasive computing types of scenarios. So that's essentially what I've got in store for you, and I'll try to make up for the lost time if at all possible, but I can't quite promise that I can speak faster, and if I do, you may not be able to keep up, and we may not necessarily win very much in the process. So just to provide perhaps a little bit of context, I think everyone has a cell phone these days. In fact, my understanding is that in Hong Kong, pretty much everyone has at least two cell phones, right? And so these are essentially... So Hong Kong is one of the most advanced markets when it comes to cell phone penetration. And the latest stats indicate that penetration is at 192%, which is about two cell phones per users. Some of you probably have three because probably some only have one, right? What you do with these cell phones, I'm not entirely sure. But certainly we can state without taking too much of a chance that most of us have a cell phone today. And we can in fact state that the vast majority of the people probably in this room have actually a smartphone already. And that smartphone comes equipped with a lot more functionality than the cell phone that we had 10 years ago. And with that functionality comes interesting challenges and interesting opportunities as well. So in particular, when you look at location tracking, which is obviously what we're going to be talking about, what we've seen over the past few years is we've seen a number of different forces making it possible for us to effectively track people's location on a continuous basis and at a very fine level of granularity. Now, location tracking is not entirely new. The basic idea of knowing someone's location is fundamental to the workings of any cellular network. A cellular network that doesn't know where a cell phone user is going to have a very hard time forwarding incoming phone calls to the right tower and making sure that that phone call eventually reaches its destination. So from the very beginning, cell phone operators have obviously known in which cell their users were. If they didn't, then obviously they couldn't serve those users. But what has changed is the fact that we can now track people's location at a much finer level of detail, as I said. And so one element of that is the very rapidly declining price of GPS chipsets. Right. So these GPS chipsets, as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, were costing somewhere between $5 and $10. And that's still a very sizable amount of money. Today, they're actually below $2. They're as low as $1. And that means that we can effectively afford to include them pretty much in any given cell phone. Right? And this is happening right now. So today, or last year, out of the billion-plus cell phones that were being sold, about a third of those cell phones actually had GPS chipsets embedded in them. Today, that figure is even higher, and that will continue to increase moving forward. What's interesting, however, is that GPS is not the only way to get a fine reading on someone's location. And I'm not talking about your traditional cell phone triangulation. Those techniques have been out there too for a while, but the accuracy of these techniques would be in the order of perhaps 100 to 200 meters and occasionally as much as a kilometer or more. And so that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about finer grain readings. We're talking about 10, 20, 30, 40, perhaps 50 meters. That's what we're talking about here. So Wi-Fi is actually another technology that makes it possible for you to get a reading on someone's cell phone and its location. The way this works is you build essentially extensive databases of access points that can be sensed at any point in time. And if you correlate that with latitude and longitude information that you might have collected with a GPS unit, when somebody will report on the MAC addresses that they see at a given point, the access points that are nearby advertising their location as part of the service discovery functionality that Wi-Fi supports, you're going to be able to correlate that with the data in your database and end up with a fairly accurate reading on someone's location, especially if that someone is in an urban area. Right. So Wi-Fi and GPS together can actually be combined. Wi-Fi actually tends to consume less power than GPS, and one constraint has been, in fact, battery life in this space. So if you take a cell phone that was perhaps produced 2 years ago, and even some of the cell phones that are being produced today, and you run GPS on them continuously, you're going to drain the battery within 3-4 hours. When you combine, however, Wi-Fi location reading and GPS location reading, and you start doing things a bit more in a slightly smarter fashion, for instance, perhaps also using readings from the accelerometer. If someone is not moving, what's the point of keeping that GPS unit going? Right, turn it off and save yourself some battery life. When you combine these things, you can actually build hybrid location tracking functionality that will enable you to, by and large, track someone continuously on a daily basis, assuming that they recharge their cell phone about once a day when they go to bed. That's essentially the functionality that we have today. That means we have now the ability to track your location on an ongoing basis, right? And people are doing that. And this is what we're talking about. This is a very brand new development. We're talking about very fine readings of your location for days after days after days, right? And by the way, this is not unique to cell phones, although cell phones are clearly playing a huge role in this space just because of how prevalent they are. But location tracking can be done through a variety of other technologies. Think about near-field communication. Think about cameras. Cameras these days come with GPS. In fact, you could argue that the most popular cameras are cell phones. So in a way, that's a bit of a... That's sort of speaking about the same scenario in some ways. But think also about toll payments, for instance, on highways. right? Think about credit card payments, right? And other schemes where you swipe various cards. All those are actually schemes that enable you to potentially collect information about the location of someone. And nothing prevents you, conceivably, to pull all that information together and get essentially a very extensive understanding of where someone is going and what that might potentially imply. So location is obviously a very powerful contextual attribute, an element of someone's context, if you want, and one that can certainly be used and put to good use, right? Knowing about nearby gas stations and hospitals and perhaps bars and banks and ATMs, all these things are very useful, and you've got apps now for all these things, there's no question. You've got, in fact, today, tons and tons of apps out there. So you look at the App Store that Apple launched, and today it has about 350,000 apps. And you look at the Android Marketplace that Google put together, and that has somewhere between 250 and 300,000 apps. And some of these apps are actually more sophisticated than what I've talked about. So you've got, for instance, and this is just one of thousands, right? You've got apps that enable you to track your path as you go jogging, and then challenge your friends by sharing that path with them and say, this is how fast I was able to go around this, see if you can beat me. Right? So there's actually also social networking element being introduced in some of these apps, and lots of other things happening. And so today there's this huge ecosystem that has emerged with increasingly a very large fraction of these apps leveraging in some manner your location. Now what's interesting is if you look more closely at these app stores and marketplaces, it's interesting to see how much people have to pay for the most popular apps. So this is a graph that shows you the correlation between the popularity of apps and how much people are actually paying for them. This is actually in US dollars, right? So this is not well labeled. So this is not an academic chart, but hopefully I've corrected the lack of accuracy on this right now. And so what this tells you is that the cheap apps are the ones that are popular, right? And so essentially you've got an environment here that somehow is not most of the time going to be able to support itself just out of the revenue generated by those apps. Now, there are exceptions. Think about Zynga and those other guys. There are exceptions, no question. But ultimately, the question is, how do most of these apps support themselves, or the people behind these apps support themselves? And the answer, obviously, is mobile advertising. Right? So mobile advertising is growing extremely fast today. It's roughly doubling, if not more than that, each year. So these are figures in the U.S. Right? Last year in the U.S., we're actually still under $1 billion a year. The expectation is that this year we're going to be surpassing $2 billion. Right? That's a very big chunk of money, just to give you a sense for what we're talking about. If you look at the online advertising business in the U.S., market size is about $20 billion. Right? And so we're reaching about 10% of that, just in a matter of a couple of years. So this is growing extremely fast. If you want to know what the worldwide figures are, you roughly double these numbers by two. That's roughly where we are. So it's actually even bigger, obviously. And so what's interesting in this space is that the way you do advertising is actually different from the way we do advertising on the fixed web. Not that advertising on the fixed web is free of any privacy issues, far from that. But the way we do advertising on the mobile web is very different. Right? So advertising on the fixed web tends to be driven by search. This is why Google is doing so well with its model with AdSense and Google Ads. But in the context of this app ecosystem, most of the advertising these days in the mobile space is actually taking place through the apps themselves. And that creates an additional incentive for all these app developers to actually try to collect your location. Right? Whether or not that app needs your location to operate properly is a different issue. The force here is whether the app developer needs your location to generate enough revenue to support himself. And that's a very, very strong incentive. Right? And so this is just an illustration, for instance, of how AdMob works. AdMob being actually a company that Google ended up acquiring because they came to realize that their search-based advertising model was not going to get them where they wanted to be in the mobile space. And then beyond that, people have come to recognize that all this location information is absolutely wonderful. It's not just necessarily about serving you ads on you know, on a one-to-one basis. There's also opportunities here to view essentially the world population and all its cell phones as a gigantic sensor network, where essentially each one of us with his one or more cell phones amounts to being a node in that sensor network, and we can just be observed on an ongoing basis. Our behaviors can be tracked, they can be mined, they can be analyzed, and they can be used then to target us for various kinds of scenarios, including sending ads that will be much more appropriate and much more likely to generate some revenue. And so you've got companies like Sense Networks, for instance, a company based in New York, that has developed this model where they essentially collect all this data and try to identify clusters of users. You've got the people who hang out at bars on Friday nights, and you've got the crowds with children who tends to have a very different behavior, and you've got the soccer moms, and you've got all sorts of other people. And each one of these tribes, as they call them, will essentially be more responsive to certain kinds of ads and less responsive to others. And so that's an example of information that you might be able to use. So when I track your location now, I might be able to try and figure which tribe you belong to and then serve you ads on that basis. The same kind of approach is also used to, for instance, keep track of traffic. Right? So if you're looking at Google Maps and traffic information, that's also the result in great part of collecting information from a number of different cell phones and identifying on that basis whether these cell phones happen to be on the road, at what speed they're moving, and on that basis determining what the traffic situation might be. And so we've got all these different scenarios and all these different forces that essentially make it possible on the one hand to collect our location and create incentives also for various entities to in fact proceed, collect that information, try to make the most out of it. And so this brings about the question of what does that mean in terms of privacy and what is location privacy in the first place? And so you can define location privacy as essentially the ability of an individual to move in public space. We're not talking about private space, obviously, in public space with the expectation that under normal circumstances, no subpoena, right, so you're not a terrorist suspect, their location will not be systematically and secretly recorded for later use. Right, so essentially an expectation that you as a citizen, as a consumer, as a user, are entitled to have some control over what happens to your location information. You are in charge of deciding whether that location information can be collected. You should be given options. You should be given information about the various services that you might be interacted with so that you can make informed decisions about whether or not you're willing to disclose your location for different purposes with these different types of services. Right? And so, obviously, if you don't have that type of privacy, then someone would be able to answer questions such as, you know, did you go to that anti-war rally, for instance, on Tuesday, or, you know, did you walk into an abortion clinic? Right, those are the kinds of things that you would be able to answer based on collecting that data without you necessarily knowing that this is happening. Have you been checking at motels at lunchtimes? Right? You can come up with many more of those. Right? Are you the person who tipped off the regulator about that rusty machine that seems to be you know, getting ready to create a disaster? Which church do you go to, or mosque, or what have you? Who is your ex-girlfriend going for dinner with? I mean, you see where I'm going. Those are the kinds of things that perhaps we don't necessarily all feel comfortable with. And these are examples of why privacy is obviously potentially important within this space. The fact of the matter, however, is that when you're looking at today's practices, by and large, very little is done when it comes to protecting location privacy. In fact, we've seen a sea of change over the past 3 years. About 3 years ago, when I would go and talk to cell phone operators and other people in this space, by and large, they were very much sitting on the fence. Everybody would say, yes, location advertising, that sounds very promising, but really we're not so sure that, you know, the regulatory framework, you know, would necessarily allow us to do that. We're not quite sure how the public is going to be responding to this. Over the past 3 years, things have absolutely changed. Right? Essentially, it's one of those phenomena where everybody's been looking at each other, and then all of a sudden people started rushing. In part, these application developers who basically had a lot less to lose than the larger organizations, right, and were basically saying, well, I've got to make money somehow. If I can make money out of that location information, I might as well do it. And then you had a number of other factors that contributed to this. For instance, there was a company called Skyhook Wireless that was behind the development of this Wi-Fi location tracking that I developed. Well, it turned out that the big players didn't really like the idea that they would have to partner with that company. Companies like Google decided that perhaps they should develop their own technology to do this. And so in order for them to be able to do that, they decided it was time to actually start using all this location information that they could collect with their cell phones that they had deployed. And so that created an incentive for these guys to do the same thing. And so when you look at the stats today, this is roughly how bad the situation is. So a study was actually published in the Wall Street Journal where people had analyzed about 101 apps, I don't know why 101, seems to be a good number. Out of those 101, 56 were sharing unique device ID with other companies. Think advertisers, for instance. Now, you might say, why does it matter if they're sharing that unique ID? Well, you can think of this as being like a super cookie, right? If you're sharing that information, you've got now the ability to track that device across lots of different scenarios. So this is extremely sensitive. 47 of these 101 apps share the user's location. Many of them without proper disclosure and without the user necessarily knowing that this was the case, right? And as I pointed out, it's not just the app developers. The device manufacturers have actually been doing the same thing. So just about, I think it was about 6 weeks ago, it was revealed at a hackers conference that, in fact, and I'm sure most of you have heard about this story, right, the iPhone was actually collecting your location information. But what was most disturbing is that this location information was actually being stored on your cell phone in a file that was non-encrypted. That means that in principle, anyone who would get his or her hands on your cell phone would be able to potentially access this data. You might say, I don't have anything to hide. Well, again, go back to that list of questions I showed you. First of all, keep in mind that one of the biggest risks with cell phones is just losing your cell phone. Tons and tons of people lose their cell phones. If you lose an iPhone and someone knows there is actually a trail of your location data for the past year on that, that's easily accessible, that might be very tempting, right? In fact, they might be able to identify you, they might be able to do tons of things with that. So the fact that this was unencrypted was extremely disturbing. The fact that this was being done without ever disclosing to users that this was being done was obviously very disconcerting too, right? And what was even more disconcerting is that within a few days, Google came forward and said, by the way, we're doing the same thing, except that we don't keep that data on the cell phone unencrypted. We tend to just ship it over. And so we're better. And Microsoft said, well, by the way, we're doing that too. And so, you know, everybody's doing that. So this is essentially how bad of a situation we're in today.
Apple actually ship the data?
Obviously they do, right? And so what Steve Jobs stated was that this was a bug. And that's right. This was a bug, right? And if you read their policy, in fact, the fine print says that they reserve the right to collect that data. Right? They actually changed their policy about a year ago, stating that they would have the right to collect that data. But this is still no reason to keep that data unencrypted on your cell phone, right? And arguably, most people who had iPhones had not tried that change in policy and were not aware of this necessarily happening.
Yes, but if this is on their policy, when do we agree with that policy?
Well, exactly, right? So how many of you have read their cell phone manufacturer's privacy policy, right? We know that the answer to that is pretty much none. Even the privacy experts don't have the time to read these things.
You're dead.
I read only parts of that, actually. So nobody has the time to read these things. This is a gimmick, right? And so this is one of the things that I want to talk about. I mean, on the one hand, and privacy laws vary from one country to another. Hong Kong actually has a fairly decent, if you allow me to state my opinion, a fairly decent personal privacy ordinance that was passed in 1996 that's very similar to, for instance, the European Data Protection Directive that dates back also to about 1998, and very similar to a patchwork of laws that unfortunately we have in the US that roughly try to do the same thing in different sectors, but not in a uniform fashion, right? And so, by and large, you could argue that, you know, those laws are taking care of things. Unfortunately, as I will argue later, the devil's in the details, right? Just saying that somehow you've got to disclose your practices doesn't necessarily ensure that people will actually be able to understand what you mean, will be able to meaningfully take the time to look at your policies and make a meaningful decision on that basis. So somehow these things have to be operationalized, and right now the regulations are not doing anything when it comes to that. And so one of the things I'd like to do is illustrate how challenging this can actually be in practice. And while on the one hand it's very easy for me to come here and blame everyone for misbehaving, as I've been doing over the past few minutes, at the same time I think one has to also recognize that these problems are actually fairly challenging, and that coming up with meaningful solutions that will essentially satisfy actual practical requirements for people to make informed decisions within this space are not trivial. At the same time, what I also hope to do is to show you that there are some promising paths forward, and so that this is not an entirely desperate situation either. So there are essentially multiple facets to this problem, right, and multiple reasons why you know, this is a fairly challenging problem. Obviously, as we've seen, and as I argued as my excuse for being late, there are scenarios where it makes sense to disclose your location. There's a lot of value sometimes in allowing someone to find where you are. But there are also lots of scenarios, like the ones we saw with many of these apps that we're talking about, where your location information will be collected for reasons that are perhaps not compatible or consistent with the requirements of the app that you thought you were going to be using, but are more frivolous in nature or more directly related to the idea that somehow this app developer that's behind the app you downloaded wants to also be able to make some money, right? And so ultimately you've got to ask yourself, has the system been optimally designed? Does it mean, is the system collecting only the information that it needs? And if you look at, for instance, the Hong Kong privacy ordinance, it actually very explicitly states that frivolous data collection should not be allowed. So many of these apps that are collecting this kind of information, and where this information is not needed for them to operate properly, are potentially in violation of that ordinance. Are practices adequately disclosed? And like I said, this is not something that's trivial to do. Are users given viable options? Right? Those are requirements that you have, for instance, in the privacy ordinance that you've got, for instance, in the EU Data Protection Directive, in many other privacy regulations around the world. The question is, how do you do that in practice, given the complexity of these apps, given potentially the variety of different conditions under which they might potentially need to collect some information about you? Right, and so as we try to answer these questions, I think it makes sense to, first of all, ask ourselves whether we care. I mean, on the one hand, you know, we have all these regulations, but you might say perhaps these regulations went too far. Perhaps at the end of the day, nobody cares. You could argue that the success of the App Store, with all these iPhone users having somewhere between 1,500 apps on their cell phone, and with these articles from the Wall Street Journal that have been published and received quite a bit of publicity, maybe the world has decided that it doesn't care, and that the fun of having these apps on their cell phones significantly outweighs the privacy downside of potentially seeing your location data being collected all the time. And so I think that as you enter this space, it's important to try to essentially ask yourself whether what you're going to be looking at is something that people really care about. So how do people really feel? Well, despite all these apps being downloaded, there are actually a number of stats that I'd like to share with you that strongly suggest that people in fact do care about location privacy. In fact, when you look also at the number of people who use, for instance, location sharing applications, which is obviously just a fraction of those location-based apps that I was talking about, these are applications where you share your location with others, you find that, for instance, in the US, only a very tiny fraction of the population is actually using those apps. A much smaller fraction than the number of people who are downloading apps on their cell phones. So about a quarter of the US population today has downloaded apps on their cell phones, but only about 4% has actually been playing, for instance, with location sharing apps. And when you try to dig a bit deeper, you find that, in fact, the biggest concern that people have when it comes to these mobile apps has to do with privacy. When you ask them, what is your biggest concern? The number one thing that you hear is, in fact, privacy. So there's clearly a concern there. But that concern, however, by itself, is not sufficient for us to be able to do very much. And so it's interesting to try to dig deeper and understand essentially what's going on behind these privacy concerns. So one of the things that we've been doing over the years is we've tried to look at people and ask them at a very detailed level to report on their location privacy preferences. How do they feel about making their location available to different entities at different points in time? Are they willing to share the location with friends, with advertisers, with different app developers? And so this is essentially an illustration of what you see. For instance, if you're looking at four different users, each one of these horizontal entries here corresponds to a given user, and you're seeing here these users reporting their willingness to share, in this case with other members of with colleagues of theirs, during the course of 3 weeks, where you've got the 24 hours of the day here, the 7 days of the week, and you've got week 1, 2, and 3. And what you see is that people's privacy preferences are actually very diverse, right? And some people tend to be willing to share more than others, right? Some people have actually fairly mixed sets of privacy preferences, where perhaps on a given day they might be willing to share a lot more than on other days, and sometimes on a given day they might only be willing to share during particular times, perhaps like lunchtime, or perhaps on weekends. Right. So what we're seeing here is we're seeing things very similar to what happened for me this evening. Right. Probably I was not as willing to disclose my location all the day, all day long to Paul here, but certainly for those 15 minutes when I was looking for this room, I would have been more than happy to share my location with him and have him come and get me so that I could get here on time to give this lecture. Right. And so this is essentially what we're talking about. Now, when you try to ask yourselves how complex are these privacy preferences in terms of what are the dimensions or what are the parameters, if you want, or the settings that I would need to expose to users for them to be able to control the conditions under which they feel comfortable sharing their location with others. And so what I'm displaying here, and I'll explain very quickly, what I'm displaying here is a chart that's the result of a number of different studies that we conducted where we followed people over several weeks at a time, and we asked them each day to essentially revisit every single location they had been at and report on whether or not they would have been comfortable sharing that location with different groups of people, such as advertisers, members of the university community. In this case, this was done with university students, Facebook friends, close friends and family. And we did that, and then having collected that data for a substantial number of users, we then tried to see, as we would expose different sets of settings to these users, to what extent they would be able to express their preferences just with those settings. So, for instance, the simplest approach here is to expose to these users what we call a whitelist mechanism. A whitelist mechanism would be for me to, for instance, say, Paul can see my location all the time, wherever I am. I'm okay with that. Right, so that would be a whitelist. And so if you do that and you give your users a whitelist mechanism, you're going to be able to actually capture a fraction of all the scenarios when you feel comfortable sharing your location. But occasionally, there will be scenarios where you're only willing to share your location with some people for a fraction of the time. And if the cost of sharing your location with those people all the time outweighs the cost of not sharing that location with them at any point in time, then you're better off not sharing. And so what you're seeing here is a measure of the accuracy that you can get. And again, I should have labeled my axis, I apologize. But what you're seeing here is essentially, I did label it, I'm sorry. So you're seeing here the accuracy that you would get with different sets of settings exposed to users. So if all you do is you allow them to toggle people on and off, basically when it comes, for instance, to friends and family, you're going to do fairly well. You're going to capture 70% of their preferences. But if you move on to, for instance, members of the university community, you're only going to be capturing about 20% of the scenarios when they feel comfortable sharing. And with advertisers, perhaps something like 12 or 13%. So clearly that doesn't cut it. If you allow them to then, for instance, further qualify their preferences, not just based on who they're sharing with, but also based on attributes such as time, then you start seeing an increase in the accuracy. Here time is hours of the day. Time plus here means I'm going to differentiate between weekends and weekdays. Then here I'm introducing also the ability to qualify things such as only when I'm at these locations am I willing to share my location with Paul. So for instance, only when I'm in downtown Hong Kong am I willing to share my location with him. If I do that, then I might actually be able to increase my accuracy, because perhaps I don't necessarily want to share with him my location when I'm in Pittsburgh. And then when you combine all these things, you can get even higher. Now this sounds wonderful, but obviously assuming that somehow people are going to specify privacy preferences that are that complex may be a little bit unrealistic, right? And so before we get to that, however, what's really interesting to know also, and I'm not going to dwell on these things, I actually presented these results a couple of years ago in another presentation, but they very much fit within this presentation as well. What's very interesting is as you increase the set of settings that you expose to users for these different scenarios, what happens is you actually end up seeing a lot more sharing. So essentially, if you give people more expressive settings, and if you assume that they're going to take advantage of these settings, which is what I'm currently doing, we're going to revisit that later on, then in fact, the amount of sharing you're going to have is going to be much greater. So in fact, if you give people control over when they're willing to share, for instance, their location with advertisers, right, and you move away from a scenario where either they share all the time or they don't share all the time to a scenario where they might say, only when I'm at malls and during lunchtime or weekends, then all of a sudden you find that, in fact, they're willing to share with advertisers about 2.5 times as much their location than if they didn't have those kinds of settings. So you would say, that sounds great. If I'm an advertiser, maybe I should actually offer those kinds of settings to users. Well, not necessarily, right? So one thing that we've omitted here is what happens in practice when you expose these settings to users. Are they going to actually define all these different rules that they would have to define to take advantage of all this expressiveness? So what do I mean by that? One example of a very typical location privacy preference that people have is I'm willing to share my location with my colleagues, but only during weekdays, only 9 to 5, and only when I'm on company premises. That's an example of a rule. And so when you look at the number of rules that people are willing to define, as if you assume that they're willing to define more and more rules, your accuracy will also go up. But in truth, the number of people who are going to define all these rules is only going to be a very tiny fraction of your population. So it's interesting to ask yourself, well, what happens if my users were perhaps to only define 2 rules, like the one for their colleagues and perhaps one for their close friends and family, such as I'm always willing to let my wife and my close friends see my location. That would be another one. It turns out that as you do that, you can actually get almost a twofold increase, or not quite a twofold, but a very significant increase in the accuracy that you're going to get in capturing your privacy preferences. And the same is true for advertisers. Actually, this was advertisers, right? If you get to 5 rules, then it's actually more than double again. So those are some of the things that are worth considering. Now, before we move on, as I promised, and these results so far are based on people in the U.S. So one question that was still in the back of my mind until about a year ago, and it still remains, but I think we've made good progress on this front, is to what extent are all these results that I have potentially just typical of the U.S. population? You've heard, I'm sure, some people argue that perhaps people in Asia don't necessarily care so much about privacy. I don't know why people say that, but I've heard that. I'm sure you've heard that too. I've heard that somehow people would say people on the mainland, for instance, have more of a collectivist culture, and therefore they're more willing to share their location. Is that true or not? Well, we decided to try and find out. So I've actually got a collaboration with a professor at Beihang University in Beijing, and we selected 2 groups of users, identical demographics, at Beihang University and at Carnegie Mellon. And we conducted a study with those for 3 weeks, collecting again their location on an ongoing basis for 3 weeks, every day, requesting them to audit every location they had been at and indicate who they would be willing to share with under different sets of conditions. And so we tracked a total of about 19,000 hours in the process, which is substantial, and then we analyzed the data. I don't have the time to share everything with you. I'll just show you a few quick results. So First of all, this idea that somehow people in Asia might have very different, and obviously everything I'm going to say here has to be qualified. This is based on these two groups of 30 users. So maybe I just happen to have taken those 30 users that are just like the US or close. But I would certainly think that this is, you know, at least the first step towards dispelling some of these, what I believe are probably misconceptions. So when you look, for instance, at willingness to disclose location to close friends and family, you find that by and large, people on the mainland, at least those people that we looked at, I cannot generalize and say this applies to people in different cities or in the countryside. These were people, students in Beijing. Those people in China and those people in the U.S. by and large were very close, with actually more willingness to disclose apparently in the U.S. Than in China. So actually the opposite of what you hear sometimes. For social networking, the same thing, as it turns out. So more willingness to share apparently in the U.S. than in China. Now there are different ways of interpreting that. Is this purely cultural or is there something else going on? There are actually a variety of factors that tend to influence these statistics. So one thing that we know, for instance, is that social networks are a bit more recent in the mainland than they are, for instance, in the U.S. So when you look, for instance, at the number of friends that people have on social networks, at least students in the U.S., you find that they've got perhaps a couple hundred friends. In China, they tend to have more like 50 or 60 friends. So that probably has an impact on those numbers. Members of the university community, this is very interesting. This is actually where you see the opposite. Right, in this case, you actually see there's a bit more willingness to share, apparently, in China than in the U.S. And so that might actually be a reflection of that more collectivist view. So we tried, and the people who did the interviews, so we didn't just collect data, we actually conducted in-depth interviews to try to understand what was going on. It seems that certainly at this university, people seem to have a very close relationship with their colleagues at universities, which seems to suggest they're more inclined or they're more willing to share their location than students might be at universities. But a small margin, in fact, to be perfectly accurate, you want to look at these p-values. So those of you who know about statistics probably know that you've got to be under 0.1 to sort of see a meaningful difference. And here I'm at 0.13, so it's a bit borderline. It's not clear that we're seeing a very meaningful difference. These other three here, those are actually statistically significant differences. Advertisers, so people on the mainland, seem to be a bit more concerned about their privacy, if anything, than people in the U.S. Now, here are a few. So let me try to break down that a little bit more for you, and then I'll move on. So by and large, I mean, there are clearly some differences, but nothing extremely different, I would argue. And we've analyzed things at a more detailed level where you can actually identify some more meaningful differences. But certainly at the course level, you find that things are fairly similar. Here's a different view of what's going on. So as it turns out, people spend most of their time at home and at work. We're actually very boring creatures. When you look at people over time in the various locations that they go to, you find that people spend about 80 to 85% of their time at about three locations, right? And all the other locations they go to, which is a very small number, typically, tends to just represent about 15%. That varies a little bit from one user to another. So it's interesting to see how people feel about sharing when they're at work or when they're at home with these different groups of people that I've identified. And you find that, in fact, for many of these locations, the numbers are actually very different. So the circles here are basically proportional to willingness to disclose your location. So when those circles in two colors are roughly the same, you see that the preferences are almost identical. So the key differences are actually related to when people are at work, interestingly enough. So apparently, people in the U.S. are actually a bit more willing to share their location when they're at work with close friends and family than people on the mainland. And also with people on social networks, apparently. And that's essentially the biggest difference that you see here. So there's a different view of essentially how private that location is. And there are actually measures of how private some different kinds of locations are for people intrinsically. You can actually show, for instance, that places where you have a lot more people, a wide variety of people coming to, tend to be places where people have less of an assumption, less of an expectation of privacy for instance. And so in this case, we're seeing these differences for work in particular. Let me just show you one more, and then I'll move on. We actually have a lot more data than that, and there are some additional differences that are meaningful. But it's interesting to see what happens when you actually allow people to modulate their location. So one of the things I started to talk about this evening was the fact that we now have the ability to track people's location at a very fine level. And I've assumed so far that people were only given the choice to either disclose their finest location or disclose nothing whatsoever. But what happens if you allow people to actually manipulate the granularity at which they disclose their location? For instance, playing between their exact location or the neighborhood within which they are, or perhaps the city that they're in or the state that they're in. But what if you gave them that possibility? How would they feel about sharing with potentially the ability to modulate the granularity, the resolution of that disclosure? Well, very interestingly, what happens then is that you find that people in China are actually more willing to disclose their location than people in the US. You find that people in the US will actually take many of the disclosures that they indicate they felt comfortable with, and they'll basically make some of these disclosures less precise, but they're not going to meaningfully increase the amount of sharing that they do. While people in China take advantage, apparently, of this extra expressiveness that you give them, this additional level of control, and collectively end up doing more sharing. And so what we're looking at here is essentially the difference between sharing, no disclosure, if you want, with the granularity, or basically at the finest level of granularity. And so, for instance, if you look at sharing with close friends and family, if you give people the ability to move away from just sharing with your finest location, you find that the no disclosure number drops from about 30% down to just a few percent. That's a very significant difference. And you see a number of those for the other figures that are being reported here. So let me show you one last one here, and this is where I'm going to stop. So we've also looked, for instance, at gender differences, and this is also fairly interesting. So for instance, when you look at willingness to share, and you've got obviously the numbers here for China and here for the US, right? Willingness to share and differences in gender, it seems that the female students in China are actually much more conservative than their counterparts in the US. So it seems that their counterparts in the US are the ones that are driving these social networks. While in China, if anything, it might actually be the male counterparts. For advertising, it seems that in general, females are not crazy about advertising, but the difference is actually more marked within the US population than it is in China. Now, there are a number of additional differences that we've identified. I don't necessarily have the time to show that. And so on the one hand, you can dissect these things and say, oh, there are a number of differences. But by and large, I think what these numbers show is that whether it's in China or in the US, and I would assume that this extends to many other regions, but again, this is based on a relatively small sample of users, so one would need to do more research to be absolutely sure that this statement is correct. By and large, we find that people actually require fairly rich settings when it comes to controlling their location privacy. They have, in fact, fairly strong views about whether or not they're willing to share their location with different people. The fact that they're willing to share a lot more, for instance, when you give them more settings to play with the granularity of their disclosure, is a further indication that they would value fairly rich settings, if at all possible. There are also some interesting implications about default settings and who the early adopters might be. Right. So if anything, this shows you that if you wanted to do mobile location sharing in China, you probably not want to start with targeting the female population. You'd be better off targeting the male population. In the US, on the other hand, maybe you want to target that female population. So early adopters might actually be different. Advertisers also, potentially some differences. And even the default settings that you might want to expose to people, as it turns out, are actually different in China and the US. So there are some meaningful differences. Location seems to be a bigger indicator in the US than in China. Time seems to be more significant for people. So for instance, we saw more willingness to share your location around meals among the students in China than in the US, where willingness to share had more to do with where they were located. So there are some differences, if you want. It's not entirely the same. But the key message that I'm trying to get across here is it seems that across different cultures, there are fairly similar expectations of privacy, and those expectations of privacy are likely to require actually fairly sophisticated levels of fairly sophisticated settings if they are to be properly captured, right? Because people have preferences that are tied to where they're located, what day of the week it might be, what time of the day, who they're going to be sharing the location with, advertising, close friends and family, etc. And so given all that, the question is this so complicated that we're doomed to fail? Is it so complicated that companies like Apple and all these app developers that we talked about earlier this evening can essentially take all these results as an excuse for saying, well, there's nothing we can do, people's preferences are just too complex, and so, you know, don't expect us to try and do anything about this, because this just cannot be done. And certainly that's the approach that they've taken in many ways. So if you look at the way, for instance, Android exposes these privacy decisions to users, when you download an app on Android, it asks you whether or not you're willing to disclose your location, that application, doesn't give you any more details, it expects you to make a decision at the time you download the app, which from a cognitive psychology perspective is the worst possible time to ask the user, because at that point in time what the user really cares about is to start using that app, and therefore that user will be more than willing to discount anything else, including his or her privacy, to be able to start using the app, and therefore that user can be guaranteed to say, yes, I don't care, go ahead, take my location, take anything, just let me use the app. And on iPhones, you've got something slightly different, but yet very similar, where you basically have a little icon here that gets displayed and also shows you which app has been collecting your location over the past 24 hours. But by that time, obviously, it might very well be too late. And so the question then is, well, could we somehow move towards more complex privacy settings? Could we potentially do better if we were to expose all these settings that I was talking about earlier and get users to somehow feel more comfortable with the options that I have available? And the answer is that certainly exposing more settings to people is not a recipe for success. And so I don't know if you remember, but about a year ago, Facebook got itself in trouble. It does that on a regular basis, and that has not prevented its user base to continue increasing. But one of the most popular options that you would get if you typed how do I, which has potentially a lot of different questions, but you typed how do I in Google and used these instantaneous results that Google returned, it would actually suggest that perhaps you wanted to delete your Facebook account. And so a lot of people were actually looking at deleting their Facebook account at the time because they were upset about all these privacy settings. There were clearly many of them, and in principle you could do pretty much anything you wanted, except that no one could figure out how to configure these things, and no one had the time to do that. And so just exposing a bunch of settings to people is no guarantee that you solve the problem. And this is not to suggest in any way that Google is that Facebook is going to disappear. Right, Facebook is continuing to do very well despite all its privacy problems, but certainly all the settings that it has exposed to users has not been a big part of its success, as far as I can tell. And so the question then is, are there more practical ways of exposing to users fairly rich settings and getting them to effectively use those settings? And here, there are actually some relatively promising results that I'd like to share with you at a fairly high level. And some of these results are based on experiments that we've been conducting with our own location sharing application called Locacino over the years. So this is an example of an application that allows people to share their location with one another, the application I wish Paul had this evening to find me, but subject to, in fact, both location and time restrictions. So you would be able to say something like, I'm only willing to share my location with Paul, but only on Thursday, June 2nd, and only between 6 and 8 p.m. or something like that, right? And only when I'm in Hong Kong. And so people can define all these different preferences if they want to, and they can also, in fact, have access to various types of interfaces that make a big difference when it comes to leveraging those kinds of settings. So examples of interfaces that really make a big difference, in contrast to, for instance, what Facebook has been exposing to its users, is the ability at any point in time to see, for instance, who can access your location. So this is an example of an interface that we've actually been able to measure. We've actually been able to quantify the benefits of exposing an interface like that to users and shown that when you do this, people feel a lot more comfortable with the preference that they set up and are actually in a much better position to refine their preferences and reach a level where these preferences are accurately capturing their desires. Other things that we've done is we've allowed people to review who's been looking for their location and then potentially provide feedback. And that feedback can then be leveraged to generate suggestions for how they might want to refine their privacy preferences. So don't necessarily expect users to fully understand. If a user specifies 3 or 4 privacy preferences, don't expect that user to be able to fully anticipate the impact of these preferences, the behavior that these preferences will give rise to. It's very hard for people to anticipate who might potentially be willing, interested in looking for them and whether or not that would be reasonable. So if you give them this kind of visibility into what's going on so that they can say, well, this person was actually looking for me and that was quite reasonable. Paul was looking for me at 6:45. He was worried. That was quite reasonable. I should have given Paul the ability to find my location, right? If I see that, then I might say, okay, now I should go ahead and change my preferences so that next time Paul looks for me, hopefully this will not happen, he will be able to find me. Right, and so when you have those kinds of interfaces, all of a sudden these more complex settings, which in practice people would not otherwise be able to take advantage of, these settings become more meaningful because you give people the tools to actually use them in a more practical way, in a way where they've got a better understanding of what the impact of tweaking all these settings really is. And so if you don't generate enough through actual scenarios, generate some what-if scenarios and tell them, here is, you know, what would have happened if this other friend had been looking for you when you were at this location. How do you feel about that? And many users are actually willing to provide feedback and say, well, I would be happy or I would not be happy. So in some scenarios, they go straight to their preferences and they tweak that directly. In other scenarios, you collect that data, and then over time, you basically generate suggestions. And you tell users, basically, you know, on 5 different occasions, you seem to be unhappy with the fact that some of your colleagues were looking for you while you were on company premises. Perhaps you should allow your colleagues to see your location on your company premises. Would you like to accept this rule, yes or no? And when you do that, in fact, you find that users can very rapidly converge to a fairly high level of accuracy. Now, let me explain again what these charts show you, because there's no way that you can actually understand this without a little explanation. So what this shows you is that there are 2 sets of functionality that can make a big difference in enabling people to leverage these more complex settings that I've been talking about, like location privacy preferences based on where you are and the time of the day or the day of the week. One is that you can actually use new types of machine learning techniques to define what we call default preferences that a meaningful segment of your population would actually feel pretty comfortable with. Not just one default. There's no good default that will work for everyone. One size fits all doesn't work in this space. But if you look at people very carefully, based on the kind of data that we've been collecting, you find that you can often subdivide your users in a small number of groups, perhaps 3 or 4 groups, and that for each one of these groups, you can actually define preferences that will get them pretty close to their desired preferences with a few tweaks. And so this is essentially what you're starting here, where you're starting with iteration 0. And so as you increase the number of groups, or personas as we call them, so if you start just with 1 default preference for everyone, you're going to do very poorly. You might only get 50% of accuracy. But if you've got like 4 groups, you say, which one of those 4 groups do you feel is closest to the way you feel about sharing your location with people? If you allow people to pick that, you're going to get them pretty close to 90% of their preferences already. And then with the suggestions I was talking about, you can get them a little bit higher over time. And after 3 or 4 suggestions, you might be very close to essentially capturing most of the preferences that matter to them. So those kinds of things make a big difference. Now, I'm sure I'm very close to running completely out of time, so I'm going to happily skip a slide here. And I'd like to get to the next step here before I reach my conclusions. So it's one thing to try and capture people's preferences when it comes to sharing their location with others, people or advertisers or app developers, but it's another thing to assume that people necessarily know what they want. In fact, the example I gave with Android where you ask users whether or not they feel comfortable sharing the location with the app they're trying to download on their cell phone, is the perfect example of why this is not working. Right? As I explained, at that particular point in time, we've got all these cognitive biases that are deeply ingrained in our brains that will get us to make the wrong decisions. It's been shown over and over again. Right? Behavioral economists have done tons of experiments and tons of studies that show that over and over again, the decisions that we make in these kinds of contexts are not the rational types of decisions that we should be making. We tend to essentially privilege short-term rewards and tend to very significantly discount long-term costs and risks that are associated with our decisions. And so when it comes to just trying to capture people's privacy preferences as people would define them, we run the risk that we might actually make it easier for people to make the wrong choices. And so the latest thinking in this space is that we want to go a bit beyond that, and that perhaps we need to better educate people also, and that beyond educating them, which only works so well, maybe we want to slightly, gently nudge them towards making the right types of decisions. Now, nudging is a tricky concept, right? And it's also referred to by our social scientists as soft paternalism. And I'm sure that term evokes various feelings among different people, because certainly the word paternalism might sound a little scary at times. And so the idea of soft paternalism is that you're not going to be fully paternalistic, you're not going to impose things on people, you're still going to give them a choice, but you're going to try to influence them so that hopefully they make the better choice. And so what that means, for instance, when it comes to location sharing, there's been various efforts that have tried to get people to recognize that when they share, for instance, their location with applications like Foursquare, which basically amount to telling the world that you're at a given place, they should think that effectively they're broadcasting their location, and they honestly don't know all the various people who might have access to that location. And so they might by default be thinking about the good scenarios, like the scenario where their friend that they haven't seen in several years, finds that they just happen to be at a bar next door, and they go and have a drink together, and they catch up on all these years where they hadn't seen each other, and that sounds wonderful. But then remind them also of the bad scenarios, where that guy who's been eyeing your flat-screen TV on Facebook notices now that you're 20 miles away from your home, and it's just about the best time to break into your apartment and steal that flat-screen TV, right? And so the idea of nudging is to somehow, at the right time, essentially try to get some additional information to users so that they might think twice before they make a given decision. Now, how do you do this in the context of location sharing? That's still an open question. This is an area that actually Google has given us money to research, and we're thinking about all sorts of different ways of doing that. One of them might just be to show the faces of various people before you share your location with others and say, by the way, this guy will also see your location. And then you realize and you say, who is this guy? I've got no idea. Well, that's exactly the point. You're giving your location to someone you don't know, and you don't know what the consequences might be. So we still need to expand with that. So in short, and this is where I'm going to try to wrap up this presentation. In short, when you look at location privacy, there are many different forces that are pulling us in different directions. There are obviously economic forces that argue for collecting as much as you can. It's certainly become feasible, economically speaking, to do that, with the price of chipsets going down, the prevalence of cell phones, and so on, and the fact that we've got this huge ecosystem of applications and app stores that essentially tries to look for sources of revenue. The question then is, you know, is this a situation where, you know, as users and consumers, we should just basically throw our hands up and say we've lost this battle? Well, as it turns out, there are a number of different solutions out there that could potentially help improve this situation, where, as I've shown you today, there are tons of people that are collecting information without your knowledge for purposes that go well beyond what is required for their application to work properly. Right. And so this range is, so there are actually cryptographic protocols that have been developed over the years. Those, and I'm not going to describe exactly how these things work, but there are cryptographic protocols that are referred to as multi-party computations that are becoming increasingly efficient, that will actually allow you as an app developer who's got, for instance, a location-based service to essentially determine what are the sets of restaurants that might be relevant to someone in a given area without knowing who that individual in that area really is. There are actually ways of doing that. I don't need to know that it's you with that particular location for me to tell you about restaurants that are nearby. You can definitely do that. There are actually architectures that can be designed that will minimize the amount of information that's going to be leaking. In fact, the fact that we're moving to 3G and now 4G today, and that we've got these much faster data rates, right? We're talking about within 10 years, we'll have about hundreds of megabits per second on our cell phones. And even today, with perhaps, you know, a few hundred kilobits or perhaps 1 megabit per second, you've got the ability today to not fall back on that default scenario where you send your location to service and that service tells you about the 10 restaurants that are nearby. Nothing prevents you from saying, I'm somewhere in Hong Kong, send me all the restaurants in Hong Kong, right? And then I'll decide which restaurants I'm interested in based on my final location. But that calculation will actually be done on my cell phone directly. And the service provider doesn't need to know. So there are ways of doing that, actually. So those are examples of what people refer to as privacy by design. So rather than trying to slap privacy on your application at the end when it's too late, try to think about it earlier. Try to inject that into the software engineering process so that you don't end up with these so-called bugs that Steve Jobs is referring to when he just realized that his developers have decided to have that file on every single cell phone that's unencrypted and that has been storing your location for the past year. Right. Disclosing practices. So as I mentioned, there is actually a fairly good regulatory system here. For instance, in Hong Kong, the same is true in the EU and Canada and New Zealand and so on. But in fact, even though this is a well-intentioned framework, that framework doesn't go far enough in terms of detailing how you can actually make this thing work in practice. The fact that you've got these six principles in your privacy ordinance here in Hong Kong, that includes, for instance, disclosing what information you're going to be collecting for what purpose and giving the user some options, that sounds great. But if that's going to be lost in a privacy policy that's 10 pages in length, that you're going to have to read from your cell phone while you're downloading an app, that's never going to work. Right? And if the only option you have available to you is to say, I'm just not going to be using that app, that's not going to work either. So we need to work towards a framework that goes deeper and that tries to provide better guidelines, more practical guidelines when it comes to essentially operationalizing these high-level principles, which are good in principle, but are not detailed enough to make anything work in practice. And ultimately, I think education and nudging is also going to have to play a big role in this space. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that all I talked about this evening is just location. But in effect, location is just one contextual attribute. You're looking at what your cell phone can do today, and it can collect a lot more than just location information. Location is the most visible part of the iceberg, and certainly the one that has, that is currently leading to the biggest challenges. But moving forward, there will be more and more information that will be collected. We're moving towards this pervasive computing environment where everything will be sensing you everywhere you go, right? And as we're going to be moving into those environments, we'll be dealing with those same issues across a much broader range of data being collected about you. And so this is where I'd like to stop and take any questions. Thank you for staying with me this late in the evening.